Welcome to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. The SAG-AFTRA Foundation believes that contributions made to our culture by performing arts are not only valuable, but also essential. And so we provide free programming and services like this podcast to support them. If you'd like to learn more about the SAG-AFTRA Foundation or access the full library of our conversations or make a donation to support this podcast, please visit sagaftra.foundation. That's www.sagaftra.foundation. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA-Found. Thanks, and enjoy the conversation.
Well, I was born in... Let's see, does it still exist? Kansas City, Kansas. Actually, I was born in the Kansas City, Missouri hospital, but we lived on the Kansas side. I think no hospital in Kansas would take me. November 15th, 1929. I was born to Russian Jewish immigrants, Morris and Lizzie Asner. Actually, Morris was a Litvak. He came from Vilna, or nearby Vilna, Lithuania, today gaining its independence from Soviet Russia. My mother came from near Odessa, and I was the last of five kids. Two boys and two girls preceded me. The time I was born, we lived above my father's junkyard, and across the street was Armour's Packing House, big, sprawling, massive meat packing. To the left, I can't remember the direction now. This is all took place in the what is called the West Bottoms of Kansas City, which means the river bottoms. And it was very near the Missouri state line. To the left, as you emerged from my father's junkyard, and down the street was Fowler's Packing House. It was all meat packing and railroad and stockyards in those days. At the end of the street, it was James Street, before you hit the river and before you actually came into the stockyards, you had the overruns, where all day long you heard the drovers driving with the popping whips that they used to herd the sheep and pigs and cattle into the packing house. The predominant population down there was Central European, Slovak, Slovene, some Austrians, and Mexicans, and blacks began to appear in the neighborhood while I was still a kid. Then it was a segregated society at that time because we bordered Missouri. The rest of Kansas was far less segregated. At the beginning of the second grade, we moved into what I term white bread village. My sister forced the family to move. She was tired of living in the cattle district. And it was called West Height Manor. It was primarily middle class, lovely neighborhood. It was a cultural shock for me. My two best friends were Mexicans, and I was a shining light in the second grade. I was everybody's darling. And I moved into this area of other, more culturally advanced kids, all white. And suddenly I felt like a dodo. I became very shy and reticent. Entered into Mark Twain grade school. And it was an 8th grade school. And The long, slow process of trying to acquire an education began. My parents spoke with a thick accent. They were quite elderly by the time I was born. My mother was in her 48 when I was born. My father was in his mid to late 50s. So whenever PTA would occur, it would these people who looked like my grandparents would show up, and it was difficult to explain it all. As well as being Jewish, I ended up in a high school of 2,000, and I was perhaps one of 10 Jews in the whole high school. So there was a lack of knowledge of Jews. There was a lack of knowledge of being foreign. So I think it was my dissatisfaction with who I was that created the first seeds of wanting to be an actor. As a kid, I loved to be selected to get up and sing the songs at our synagogue on Friday night, to be cast in the Sunday school plays, and to be cast in the grade school plays. I never volunteered, never, because everybody would think you were a sissy if you volunteered. So I was always delighted when I was chosen. And I always worked very hard at singing the loudest. I definitely achieved volume. Whether I achieved good notes is someone else will have to judge. And that went on until high school. Being made very aware of my Jewishness, all my friends, I felt, would be selected for their brothers' fraternities. We had the fraternity system in high school. And I would be left behind. I felt automatically I would be left behind. And it occurred. We came in as freshmen. We still hung around, had new friends, and made new friends. I had a very tough time adjusting in my freshman year. I became a clown, always getting into trouble. And I had a wonderful English teacher named Louise Timmer. Sounds like something out of Dickens. The kind of needle nose that in the winter when she'd get colds become red and drip and very prim and proper and severe. Always a little smile being stifled. And I was always screwing up and getting caught making noise or doing something. And she was always punishing me. And her punishment for me was memorizing poems and reciting them to the class. So I was constantly having to extend my memory this way from my freshman year on. And I found it easy, and My buddies envied my facility at this. I went on to graduate with a certain amount of achievement from high school. It was the day of the Beatnik, Kerouac, etc. We graduated in 1947. I had succeeded in football and journalism, somewhat in drama. I was supposedly a success. World War II had ended 2 years previous, not even 2 years. And I think, certainly for myself, I can't speak for most of my peers, but we felt cheated. I felt totally dwarfed by all of the people who had participated in World War II. At the same time, most of us felt that we would eventually be drafted, so that we would have to put in the time, put in the duty, but get none of the glory. I think that weighed on us. At the same time, I wanted to get away from the constraints of family, of Midwestern propriety. I wanted to live life. College, after lucking through high school as I had, held no magic for me. My sister had returned from Alaska, where she spent working during the war. And she was very kindly wrote applications for me and my buddies. We would write to the ships plying the Alaskan coastal waters, trying to get cabin boy jobs. We even answered an ad in the paper, which talked about pipeline workers in Venezuela or someplace in, I'm not sure about Venezuela, closer to the Amazon, of course. Pipeline workers needed who would have to bring their own weapons to fight off blow dart natives, poison dart natives. Well, I wasn't sure I wanted to do that, but we did write a letter inquiring about it. We never got an answer. But I didn't have the gumption or the defiance to just say, forget it, and hit the road. I didn't have that kind of guts. And no job materialized, so I said, well, I was too bourgeois to say I'm not going to college. So we applied at a number of universities. Once again, most of my friends ended up going to KU, Kansas University. That didn't really hold any magic for me, since I didn't think I was good enough to play college football. So I wanted to strike out. I wanted to break away from home and make a new beginning. I was accepted at the University of Chicago. I had a cousin there in political science, and I considered political science. I knew it was a widely thought of school, highly thought of school. And it was far enough from home. I decided to go to summer school and take a course called Social Science 3, which is almost all economics. My little roommate came home from class one day and he said, you're going to summer school, they're going to do T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral. Check it out of the library and read for it. You can do any of the roles in it. I said, fine, I'll think about it. I don't know what pushed me to do it, why it was so almost fated that he should come home and do that. I checked out the book. I read for it. They acted impressed. And I was about to go home for vacation before starting summer school. And they said, first they said, well, read this role and that role. Work up on those two roles. I said, okay. And then before I left home, they came to me against, also work up on this role and this role. I said, hey, you know, just decide what you want me to read. But I'm not going to do all that work. In those days, you see, I wasn't hooked. So they told me to work on Thomas and some other role. I went home, came back. I'm sure the amount of work I did was maybe read through it once, twice. I'm not even sure there was Thomas. There was one of the tempters and one of the knights that they asked me to work on. I came back and they were double casting. They were going to have three different actors play Thomas. I came back and it seemed that they were stuck. None of their Thomases were due back in time. So they wanted me to step in as Thomas. Then one of the previous Thomases returned. Now, we were to do it three nights. So they could not decide who was to do it two and who was to do it one. And on the alternate night, you would do the fourth tempter. So I began doing my work, and everybody became very impressed. I loved it. I began hanging out with a girl in the chorus, who turned out to be the daughter of the dean of anthropology. And when they finally chose, I got the two nights of doing Thomas and the one night of the tempter, the fourth tempter. I was so inexperienced, I was strong but inexperienced, that on the night I was playing the fourth tempter, I was on a high platform with the fellow playing Thomas, and he blanked out. Or he took a very, very long pause. And I came through very quickly, mumbling, but I'm sure it was quite apparent to the audience, his next lines. And he picked it up and very haltingly finished this very key scene. It is the fourth and final tempter. So I later was made to realize that I was a little too obvious in cueing him. So I realized I had to watch my ego in that respect. But I was pretty sensational. And on the second night, where I throw myself before the altar and leave myself to the mercy of God, after making my decision to, in essence, allow myself to be assassinated, one of the knights and tempters named Shag Donahue became a wonderful writer for The Atlantic, among other publications. And he ran a little wonderful bookshop in the vicinity of the university called the Red Door Bookshop. And as the curtain came down, he said, "Great, great, fantastic, fantastic." And that's all I needed. Oh, no, I was kneeling in front of the altar, and he said this, and I nodded in assent, almost as if I were praying. I became hooked. At the same time, I'd fallen in love with this girl. Life had blossomed for me like I don't think it ever had. I felt a freedom, a bursting forth that had been so trapped in me that, and in later years I look back on it as, once again, the Frog Prince. And I explained to my brother why it meant so much to me shortly after that. The ability to become somebody else, the ability to take on many guises, many different roles, a lot of unpleasant description has been given about actors, of course, the years. I saved a clipping which unfortunately got lost. Some half-assed psychoanalyst referred to actors as unfinished people, and that they were busy acting in their attempts to finish themselves. And the strong possibility that is always there. I realize that. In my own case, I felt that it provided me that initially, the ability to leave behind the ugly duckling. But as I began to perform more and more and more, appear before audiences, to blend and meld and shape my characters, to become proficient, and to, in essence, eventually develop my craft. I felt that it ceased to be that. It ceased to be my therapy, and only served as therapy in terms of a man's profession, a man's calling, serving as therapy. I often quote what Ben Hecht said of actors after a long chapter on Barrymore. And he replied that when he was asked what he felt about actors, he said, if I should die and go to heaven and find it populated by actors, I would not be unhappy. And I like to think that's true. About this time, my parents discovered, my father discovered, that I was not cutting the mustard study-wise, and that I was involved with a lady. And my chips were cashed in. I had more or less already dropped out of school anyway. They asked me to come home and get my act together. I left the girl with thoughts that we would go home, work, make some money, and hopefully find some way to use David Green to get into the Abbey Theater. Went home, moped around for a number of months, tried my life as an encyclopedia salesman, became nauseated at the sales practices I found there, worked in a shoe store with no results, and finally took a job in a General Motors auto factory as a polisher and buffer. It was my, other than working for my father and being a drugstore delivery boy, this was my first exposure to the real world. The cars were going through at close to 70 an hour at that time. This is 1949. We worked like animals. It was an open shop plant. The union was a farce. The plant was filled with finks. And the first day, I was put on roofs. And I had a middle section of the roof to polish. And I tried to do it as the foreman instructed me, which was not the way the experienced workers did it. He wanted a flat pad. Experienced workers would skim their pad. So it made it very easy to polish the car. I kept trying and trying and trying. And in essence, I fought the machine rather than let the machine do the work. And I was sweating buckets that first day, the first morning. And I kept jumping off as soon as I'd finish a job and run to the fountain and get a drink. Finally, at one point, this foreman caught me running to the water fountain. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Going to get a drink." "You don't get a drink until you get out of the hole." Okay. Not only was I in the hole, I was forcing the workers following me to go into the hole. So I got back up on the stand and began polishing my roof again. And finally I said, "I'm never going to do this." And I hung up my machine and I looked around for the foreman to quit. And all I could see was I was forcing the guys into the hole constantly. And I wasn't doing them any favor. So I said, "All right. Until I find the foreman, I'll go on working." I kept on working, kept on working, kept on. Finally, I got to lunch. And I hated to quit. So I ate my lunch. I felt better. I limped through the afternoon. The foreman never liked me, and I never did good work. So he wanted to get rid of me. So the guy with fenders and hoods came along. And he was willing to take me. So I spent the rest of the time of that 6 months doing fenders and hoods. I saved my money. The girl and I broke up long distance. We found that you couldn't get into the Abbey unless you knew Gaelic. So that dream was spoiled. And in August, I went back to Chicago to act when and where I could. They also wanted me for a production of Julius Caesar. You could be out of the college and still act in their plays. So I went back to get jobs and to do Julius Caesar. I did Brutus. I was good. Began a series of jobs. I lived on the second floor of a Yiddish academy a friend of mine managed. I had one window which looked on an air shaft. And it probably was the most depressing period of my life. By this time, I had worked selling shoes. I had worked trying to sell over the phone, failed at all of it. Finally got a job driving a cab, failed at that. Got a job working in the steel mill as a hooker helper. That was okay. It was Carnegie Steel and Gary. But they paid like $1.23 an hour. I couldn't stand it. I had vowed never to go back to an auto plant. And yet friends of mine were getting jobs at the Ford plant in Chicago and making $1.90 an hour. I couldn't stand the thought of not making that money. So I went back to the auto plant and signed in as a metal finisher. They taught me the craft. I was a good metal finisher. And it was a union plant. And that's where I became a union man, encountering the total difference between what life had been like in an open shop auto plant and a closed or union shop auto plant. All the difference in the world, and above all, the fact that we were treated as human beings. And I stayed there until I left to go into the Army. Even when I was doing all those jobs in the auto plant, it said, I knew I wanted to be an actor, and I felt that this would teach me how to at least be every man, common man. Its strength and its gain was there. I can remember in the first year at Playwrights, which was the name of our theater, Zora and Elaine May, who eventually joined us there, which is where she met Mike Nichols, would talk about how when I became histrionic, my jaw would become fixed, and it probably became an ugly image. They said, everybody has their point of tension. My point of tension was my jaw. And so I began to work at loosening that tongue, letting my toes take the tension if you needed tension, letting some form of the body take the tension. But like the diver getting ready for, or the relay race in swimming, shaking, getting rid of that tension. And so I got it out of my face, and I suppose I stuck it into the floor of the stage. I don't know. I went through various parts where different parts of my body became the tension point. But I kept it out of my face. The best teacher, the only teacher I ever really had, was Mira Rostova, who's still teaching in New York. A wonderful teacher, and I was introduced to her when I finally came to New York by Mira, by Zora Lampert. And Mira's, and I'm not saying that I ever really conquered Mira's technique, which is called the technique of doings. What, primarily active verbs, what are you trying to do to the other person, when you were saying this line? Convince them, inform them, ridicule them. A myriad of choices one can make when one thinks of active verbs. And if one can create the proper build of doings, one should not be in error in effectuating what that character is doing in that play at that time. Now, granted, some people are ineffectual in performing doings. I suppose that's, or they are ineffectual in doing a good job of informing, doing a good job of convincing, or maybe they're bad at ridicule, or they shy away from. But if they do it, then the play will be done. I can remember a character actor named Arnold Soboloff who was in our class. He was doing a Shaw piece, and Mira critiqued him afterwards. And I went up to her afterwards, and I said, yeah, but his movement was so terrible. And his Bronx or Brooklyn accent was coming through. She said, that's not my job. I'm to teach him to act. He either has to have that elsewhere before he comes to me, or to do that role, he'll have to go to somebody else to have him teach how to speak like an English gentleman and to move like an English gentleman. And I was struck by that she was isolating that idea of acting into that very small pocket of being to be able to generate, to transmit what that role says and does. And the trappings of voice and diction, somebody else has delivered. I came to New York in 55 with my press clippings. Decided to blanket the streets with my resumes and pictures, and got a one-night performance at the Phoenix Theater in which I howled like a wolf in a production of Venice Preserved. Had seen the producers of Threepenny Opera, who were very angry at us for doing a pirate production in Chicago, but they still appreciated me and brought me into the company in February of 56. In April of 56, I was elevated, thanks to Leon Janney, who was departing the role, into the role of Peachum. And from April 56 until October of 58, I did the Threepenny Opera. We made $65 a week before taxes, and we're granted the ability to go and do TV anytime on a very short notice. So I tried to work my way up in television in New York, Studio Ones, the Sunday morning shows, Camera Threes, etc. An occasional Kraft, Armstrong Circle Theater, various specials. I kept waiting to be discovered for Broadway. Never happened. Couldn't get arrested. In December of 60, I did my first Naked City as a detective lieutenant. It was Robert Duvall's, one of his first appearances in New York. And it was Sylvia Sidney's return to film. The show went very well. In March or February or January and February of 61, I did Claudius for Ellis Rabb at Princeton in his first or second year of the APA group. And I did a good job there. In the meantime, Naked City was running short on film. So they decided to repeat my character and send me to Los Angeles with Paul Burke on an extradition case, while they shot another episode in New York with Harry Belliver and Horace McMahon. Shot one day in New York with Billy Graham shooting, flew to Los Angeles with Paul, and continued shooting there with Elliot Silverstein. Frank Sutton and Bobby Blake were the criminals, two brothers that we were extraditing, Marty Balsam was their lawyer, and they were his wards. They made a phenomenal break from the courtroom, in which I was badly wounded again, killed Marty Balsam, and were eventually apprehended by Paul Burke. It's a good show. I was introduced to L.A. Everybody insisted I see this one and that one. And I called my wife after the first week and said, I think I want to stay another week and meet people. And she said, oh, God. She saw the handwriting on the wall. At the end of the second week, I had an agent who wanted me, with whom I am still signed, Jack Fields. And I said, I think I want to move out here. My wife said, oh, God. Now, that was March. Came back, sublet our apartment, got everything packed up and ready to go. And then, miracle of miracles, I got a Route 66 in Youngstown, Ohio, the week we were to leave. So we pulled our U-Haul. We sent some by movers and pulled our U-Haul to Youngstown, Ohio. I did the show there with Darren McGavin and Lois Nettleton and came to California. And I was the luckiest person in the world because I came to L.A., this is May of 61, with a very good agent and two very good pieces of work about to show, The Naked City and the Route 66. And they immediately began squiring me around town. And within the remaining months of that year, I got enough jobs. One was the Outlaws, another was Target the Corruptors. But somehow I made more money that year and the remainder of that year than I ever made in any full year in New York or before. So California was the promised land. I joined the Screen Actors Guild in Chicago because it was easy to do at that time. I joined it before I left for New York. I joined both the Guild and AFTRA. We became equity at our theater in Chicago, which facilitated my being able to join the Guild and AFTRA at that time. I figured that it would be best to go in with a union card into New York rather than face the difficulty there of getting one. I don't know that it made that much difference, but at least that part was out of the way. Came to L.A. in 61, really had nothing to do with the union until as I worked my way up in the ranks of jobs, came to know a number of actors, so that in the period of 70 or 71, the independent group of actors that was beginning at that time, trying to run a slate, trying to break what was considered domination by the old boys routine. I live in a house now where one of the activists of that group, Elizabeth Allen, lived. She too was involved with the independent movement. I am told I wrote the platform, the preamble for the independent movement, which was in 1972, I guess. I can't remember most of the names involved. Bert Fried was involved, Kent McCord, a number of other people. But I was presented the case that the guild tended to be a closed shop in many people's eyes and needed to be opened up more. I was naive about the politics. I did not serve on any committees. But I agreed to go and address the executive committee in terms of creating multiple candidacies for the elections. John Gavin was president at that time. Remember Claude Aiken smiling at me from the executive seat he occupied? Can't remember who else was there. Don, I don't remember. I went there, was unprepared, made a very weak presentation, was not that well received, because I could see behind the smiles greeting me that I was ineffectual. And when I left, I can remember Chet Mignan confiding to my little ear. He said, you're not well served to present this to them, because what you're asking them to do is diminish their power. What I simply asked to do was to create multiple candidacies endorsed by the guild itself. The guild still doesn't do it, but I wouldn't expect them to. At the same time, the ability to run, to campaign, I think has been made easier for independent candidates. At the same time, I was focused on my own career. I did not want to become involved in the union per se. I had been asked to do so when I worked at the auto plant in Chicago, but knowing I was going to be drafted, the black workers, my fellow black workers on the line, came to me and asked me to run for office there and then, feeling that they would get a fair shake from me. And I regretfully stated that making cars was not going to be my life's work, and I was preparing to be drafted into the Army anyway. So they would be better served to find someone else. That was 72, and Mr. Heston was involved in quashing the candidacy of Bert Fried at that time. I believe Kent McCord was the only member to get into the guild at that period. But slowly over the years, the independents began to field more and more candidates and to get more and more officers in there. And I think it culminated with the election of Dennis Weaver, followed by Kathleen Nolan. And Kathleen was followed by Bill Schallert, and Bill was followed by me. Patty Duke, and now Barry Gordon. I think that it shows a broad selection, a free selection, and in essence, in short, I think the guild is much more open now than it used to be. And it is not the old boys club. It is a very active, throbbing organization responding to the needs of its members far better than I think it used to. When the strike was called in 1980, Lou Grant was quite a popular show, highly regarded. It became the idea of the guild. And when the strike was to be announced, we got a call on the set of Lou Grant to please come to the guild and appear at a press conference calling the strike. Now, we thought the casts of many shows would be called to stand in solidarity. We got there, we found we were the only show. I guess because we were the most intelligent show on the air at that time. So there are about four or five members of the cast there. We quickly polished up whatever we needed to in responding to any questions from the press about why the strike was taking place and tried to talk to it as intelligently as possible. We did a good job. Alan Williams, Daryl Anderson, Bobby Walden, and Mason Adams were there. Perhaps Jack Bannon was, I'm not sure. And as the strike went on and on and on, I began to get more and more calls to appear as spokesman for the union. That press conference was very quickly followed. Ted Koppel was just starting up with Nightline at that time. And I got a call to go down and be on the Nightline show. Well, when I got there, I was distressed and amazed to find that I was the only one representing the union. I thought that was scandalous, because I wasn't that attuned to the actual negotiations. And so I called and I raised holy hell with whoever I could reach. I was ready to walk off the show, actually. The producers had their chief negotiator there, Billy Hunt, I think his name was. And I said I would not appear face to face with him because I was too insecure and knew I could not hold up my end for the guild. So they said, well, we'll have you separated. So they had me separated. I felt no fright. I got on and I talked easily. Hunt seemed to be very taciturn, did not want to volunteer very much. So I was able to project a certain amount of thunder. And out of that came a slogan. Well, there was one joke in which the crew broke up and which... what's his name? Koppel said, well, why are you striking now? This is after going through the reasons of the strike. And I looked at him and I said, well, when would you like us to strike? And the crew just fractured him. And he realized his mistake. And then later on during the show, Hunt was talking about the product. And I responded by saying, we are the product. It became a slogan during the strike and was a fairly effective piece of fluff. That was a bitter strike. We were out for 13 and took us 3 more weeks to get back to work. I was unsatisfied with the resolution of it. It turned out it wasn't that bad after all. But I was very fired up. I was very enamored at what we were doing and felt that we had not been properly rewarded for our strike. Was not too happy, of course, at the treatment accorded us by other unions, primarily the Teamsters, and above all, the equipment operators, who served as Teamsters and as entrepreneurs of their own, running equipment to the studios, who attacked us and tried to almost blockade our benefit, which was held at the Hollywood Bowl. We settled. And a large number of us decided to stay together, to talk union, and to see that we did not fall into this difficulty again when the time came of a long, costly strike. In the meantime, veterans of the board members, came to me and said that to change the structure of the union, we had to work for merger with AFTRA, coterminous of contracts certainly was called for, many pie in the sky ideas. and that this agenda could best be carried out if I came in as president. I listened to these blandishments and was emotionally swayed to the point I said, okay, I will be another Moses. Campaigned against a good president, a fine president, Bill Schallert, because of my being a bigger celebrity at the time. I won the election, and immediately, at my first meeting, found myself in hot water. The board was voting again on aiding the families of striking Patco workers. And there was a great deal of confusion in the minutes. It turned out that they had successfully passed this aid before, but it was passed again, at least in the Hollywood branch, at this meeting. Also at this meeting, it became revealed irregularly that the awards committee, with three meeting members, had decided to select Ronald Reagan to receive the SAG Award of the Year. Everyone who became aware of this felt it would be terrible, terrible folly to let this happen. Those more experienced in union politics. He was embarked on his destruction of Patco at this point. All of the world of labor was turned against him for this act. And for us to honor him at this time would have been doing the cause of labor a great injustice. So it was decided by the wisest heads in the union that we must override the selection of the award committee and revoke it, hoping against hope that the word would not leak out. Well, that's an impossibility at the Screen Actors Guild. We did revoke it almost unanimously. Word eventually did leak out. So I would say that, and unfortunately, Chester Mignon, our executive secretary at that point, who also announced his resignation that night, had already informed President and Mrs. Reagan. So he then had the embarrassing task of saying it was canceled. From that point on, I seem to have become the emblem of the guild. In early December, Charlton Heston, who had appeared very happily with me at the benefit, regarded me as a fine fellow, began attacking me in the press, dishonestly. I thought, that's a very strange thing to do. Why is he doing this? The gist of his dishonesty was saying that I was talking about El Salvador at board meetings. Even as naive as I was, I knew I could not do that. But they knew of my affiliation. The attacks went on until February 15th of 1982, when I went to Washington as one of the founding board members of Medical Aid for El Salvador. We made our announcement of our initial donation for medical aid. And I was at the same time challenging the president and Secretary of State Haig. Because I read the opening statement, which was a joint statement. Howard Hessman was there, Ralph Waite, Lee Grant, Bert Schneider, Bill Zimmerman. and I was the reader, so to speak. I did not make it I. Or I did not say, I am not here appearing as the president of the guild. It was a joint statement. Later in the question and answer session at this press conference, I stated that I was not appearing as the president of the guild, nor was I using one penny of the union's money. But because I did not say anything in the opening statement, Charlton Heston made a capital case out of it. The press ran with it, misinformed, made it seem that I was appearing as president of the guild, and even in some people's eyes made it was conjured up that I was giving union money for medical aid. I was vilified, excoriated in the press. This went on for a few months. Boycotts were formed to boycott me, the show, CBS, whoever sponsored the show. And some sponsors dropped out. I was assured by a vice president of CBS that sponsors were standing in line to take their places. Finally, in May of that year, the show was canceled, supposedly due to ratings. A great hullabaloo ensued. Demonstrations took place outside of CBS. They consistently denied that that was why they canceled the show. I got all kinds of rumors about William Paley getting calls from the White House to cancel the show. And finally, in May, it became a fact. Interestingly enough, Bill Zimmerman, who was the creator of medical aid for Indochina and who created medical aid for El Salvador, after the show got canceled, and I would run into him at various meetings or of our group, and he'd always avoid my eyes. And finally, I said, "Well, what's wrong?" He said, "I don't watch TV." He said, "You got to understand that." He said, "I thought you were number one," meaning in ratings, which we weren't. He said, "I didn't think they could get to you." And it was an intriguing admission on his part that they could get to me. And it makes me realize that during the past years, beginning to act at the end of the 40s, early 50s, coming back from the army in 1953, being made very, very aware of the blacklist, being made very, very aware of our group in Chicago, for instance, getting threats from McCarthyites, being regarded as a liberal group, coming out of the University of Chicago and identifying with the liberal philosophies. And realizing that to be an actor at that time, you had to really walk softly in terms of political philosophy. And fearfully, all those early years, I realized I had a very big debt to pay. One, that I had been a Jewish boy growing up in America during Hitler. And two, that I was a small potatoes actor, an amateur actor for the most part, at the time of the blacklist. Because had I been in either place at the wrong time, I would have been dead. And so I walked fearfully for a lot of years there, kept my mouth shut, and felt a coward because of it. I can remember discussing with my next-door neighbor in 1963, I believe it was, after having read an article about Kennedy's advisors in Vietnam. And though I was arguing with an old-line Democrat that I should watch my mouth because I might say something intemperate which he might introduce later to haunt me, and perhaps blacklist me. During Vietnam, kept my mouth shut. And at the same time, was small potatoes still in terms of film. And there were plenty of bigger names to fry and to demonstrate for peace. In 1972, I remember seeing in the LA Times the little paragraph in June talking about the Watergate break-in. And I thought, I was in the middle of Mary Tyler Moore at the time, but I was predominantly surrounded by Republicans. The only real Democrat that I could point at was Jay Sandrich, our director. And here was this squib talking about the break-in. And I knew that it was an enormous crime and they would have repercussions. Unfortunately, the repercussions didn't develop until after Nixon was elected by a landslide. And I kept my mouth shut even there and then. Finally, rising to stardom in my own show, I never thought of medical aid as being that defiant a creation, even though in our statement we stated, President Reagan, Secretary of State Haig, your enemies are not our enemies, meaning the people of El Salvador. And at the press conference, in the questioning, a cable reporter, Mary McGrory, after this press conference, came up to me. I didn't know who she was. And she said, what'd you think of that press conference? And I said, and I didn't want to seem weak by saying I thought it was tough. I said, what'd you think? She said, I thought they were hostile. I said, yeah, I did too. And during the course of the questioning, this cable newsman said, you say you're for free elections in El Salvador. I said, yes. He said, what if they elect a communist government? And for the first time, I realized the morass I was trying to walk over. That no matter what I would answer, if I didn't give the truth, I would be a weasel. And I weaseled an answer. Went on to the next question and realized that having come this far, how could I weasel? And so I turned to him. I said, I wasn't satisfied with my earlier answer. I would say to you, if it's the government those people elect, let them have it. And when I said that, I had an eerie, uncanny feeling that I was signing my death warrant. Now, that question was never brought up or responded to in the press after that. But I feel the whole attack launched upon me at that point was based on that answer. A very typical case in point was later on when I was the show was under siege and barrage. I found that every time the press would refer to me and to the incident, they would say, Edward Asner giving aid to the Marxist communist guerrillas of El Salvador. It would be automatically worded in that way, not giving medical aid or giving it to the people of El Salvador. I was fully prepared not to work again ever. I was willing to pay that price. But that when I returned to Los Angeles after that appearance in Washington, D.C., and the attacks kept up and up and up and were fostered over, I mean, death threats, everything, fostered over inaccuracies and lies, I had an inner adjustment in which I said, you sons of bitches, I was ready to pay the price and walk away if necessary. But these attacks I will not take. And in responding to the attacks, I stayed in the arena of activity in the arena of combat. Now, the jobs may have stopped, but what kept on going was my constant appearance in the press politically. So that kept me viable, so to speak. And that's the last thing I wanted. I couldn't get off that fast speeding express, but I did not disappear gently into, I didn't disappear into that gentle good night and stayed the battle axe, I guess, that people see me as. The strike in 80 was an important strike in this respect, because much of my problem stems both politically and in terms of labor. It was the opening of the residual areas of performance, cassettes, cable, pay TV, very undefined, at least for us, I think even in terms of management, ill-defined means of establishing profits, of establishing remuneration. And that's what the strike of 80 boiled down to. And that's what created all the recrimination, because in the main, a great lack of knowledge. The interesting thing about becoming president and not knowing the inner workings of the guild, not knowing the fine printing in the contract, and being assured by my ardent supporters that, you know, I would be spokesman, but they would do all the grunt work. While it is my profound belief that there is no blacklist without the assent and cooperation of liberals, and that in trying to conduct the offices of president, I found, as often as not, on the surface, my biggest grief and problem would come from liberals trying to tell me of how foolish I looked not being proficient in the details of the presidency. They would engage in it in the board meetings. They would engage in it publicly. And the very people who were supposed to support all too often were my primary detractors in the meetings. I tried to weather that. I tried to learn. I was undergoing great stress at the time, of course. Dissolution of my marriage, the dissolution of my TV show, the threats, the constant battle, and all too often I discovered that the hardest thing in the world is to achieve unity of liberals, because as soon as there is power, as soon as there is a majority, the fringes will begin to attack each other, destroying your majority and weakening the body so that disease can enter. I found that constantly to be the case with the guild, in terms of so-called liberals on one issue turning and devouring each other on another issue they might disagree on, and even including, you know, when I as a liberal would propose this, common sense and rationality would take over, and they would show where I was wrong. So that ability to unite behind an emotional purpose rather than an objective purpose became too difficult for many of them. And the best case in point, I think, and Bill Charlotte was saying it the other day, of how wonderfully well this absorption of the extras went through in terms of the vote, biggest vote ever. And that this was regarded as a fait accompli early in my administration, the taking over of the SEG. There was regarded as no problem at all. It's absorbing 1,500 new members. Most of the members of SEG already had SAC cards. But it became the cause celebre for Charlton Heston, for all the stunt people, and for day players who felt that they would be threatened by this recognition of the extra. Because we were working so hard to be fair. When we sent out the referendum the first time, it was fought in the boardroom that we should present a minority opinion from the board. Now, there were Heston people in the boardroom, so they naturally created a minority opinion, which went out paid by union funds and helped sway the mass of the voters out there so that we could not muster a 60% majority. So the first time I think we had like 58% the first time. And the second time we lost by an even worse loss. We only garnered 52% of the vote. I could be wrong on these figures, but we had a majority each time, but lost each time because we didn't have 60%. And Bill felt that it was the first time in Guild history we had ever sent out a proposition where we exposed our throats to the enemy. I mean, we had reasoned it, we had championed it, we had examined it from up and down and every form of detraction and distraction as to why it would be right for the Guild to do it, particularly if the Guild was going to display any solidarity in the labor movement. And for the first and only time, the Guild allowed the dissenting opinion to go out. Now, call it freedom. But it was vastly blown out of proportion. Nobody really understood why it was necessary. Since the Guild represents extras throughout the world, other than the West Coast, they could not bring it into their hearts and minds to understand why. So the vote was defeated on two grounds. People who voted as elitists, who cannot stand the thought of being an actor and associating with an extra in the same union, perpetuating that Guild idea, and fear from the day player or whoever that his job would become threatened. The independent group that we operated with in the early 1970s was called CAC, Concerned Actors Caucus, I believe is the name of it. Then during the strike of 1980, actors, a number of us formed a group called Caucus of Artists for Merger. I believe, CAM. And we regarded that the biggest blow suffered by the union during the 1980 strike was the fact that we were not merged with AFTRA, that it had worked against us, that it had injured us, that it had hurt us. And the primary purpose in running for president was to achieve merger of the unions. We used to exchange with each other the fact that supposedly the Italian unions were all merged and that they had gone on strike once for 5 minutes. Now, having been president and having gone and witnessed other performers' unions throughout the world, Britain, etc., Australia, I don't think anybody comes close to our actual strength. Now, Britain may, by its unity, but I don't think, I think they rarely strike, and I think the benefits that they achieve don't approach what we get here. And that, I was elected in 1981. That's 9 years ago. There had been many attempts at merger of AFTRA and SAG before. This has been a nine-year period of striving desperately with all kinds of merger committees meeting between the two groups. And I gather that within the next year or so, God knows, it finally will come to a vote wherein the members of both unions are going to vote whether they want to be merged or not, or whether they want or can achieve cross-crediting in terms of pension and welfare. Some means of exhausting all the ways of merger will be presented to the membership. And that's the sad part about it, that it's taken so goddamn long. Well, I speak of my 7 years of activity in the Guild as being probably the the most costly education I could ever hope to achieve in terms of what I experienced there. I wouldn't take $1 million in exchange for the experience. I wouldn't take $1 million to relive it. That's way too cheap. I learned enormously about life there, about people, and realized that earlier I wanted to pursue my own pursuits in terms of career, in terms of the political activities I had always been involved in. And those ardent, staunch supporter and believer in unionism, felt that it would be a bottomless pit once I entered that field. I turned out to be correct. And I learned that a little unionism is like a little cancer. There is no such thing. That you cannot be a dilettante. There are many who play at it, but it is a cause because it is working under such terrible oppression, terrible odds, that one has to devote one's life to it to be able to do a good job. Those involved may, if they can sequester themselves to one particular area and master that, perhaps may serve their union that way. But to try to be a good guild unionist across the board is a full-time job. And I found that being the dilettante, you may serve by being used by others, but you don't bring yourself happiness. And I feel, in terms of not regretting the schooling, I feel I achieved a very large watershed for the Guild in terms of the determination of unionism and what it stands for and identification with unionism. But it was what it cost me in achieving that. That was costly. The vituperation, the castigation, the biting my tongue, the trying to be a president to all the people, doing favors for enemies here, only to find that they were still enemies, that didn't mean a damn thing. I mean, I learned the world of politics. I found it in terms of going to Sacramento and campaigning for the Guild in terms of trying to achieve things for the Guild there. Finding the fair weather friends of politicians to be as despicable as anyone else. And if it served their purposes, they'd support us. If the funds coming in, and sort of we had no funds to give them, but if funds were coming in from some other source, the hail fellow well met, please come to my ball wasn't as important as it had once been regarded. I hope I'm not being too cryptic when I say this, but I serve best as being spokesman, as being able to get up there and write the letter and be able to speak to it in terms of interviews, being able to make the speech. I'm an excellent speech maker. But the Guild thrives and needs more than the speech maker. I created the image, others implemented it. And in some cases, it was great. In other cases, my naivete, the bottom line, I guess, of what I was saying is, there are some so-called liberal throats I should have cut.
Thank you for listening to the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations podcast. If you appreciated what you heard, please support us with a review or donation and reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SAG-AFTRA Found. We'd love to hear from you.